conference, free conference meeting. This is the first free conference committee meeting on Senate Bill 141. I would like to welcome our colleagues from the other body to Senate Finance. Representative Cortula, Representative Kelly, Representative Hawker. I'd also like to welcome Senator Elton, who comes into the chambers on occasions, and then, of course, Senator Wilkin and myself, Senator Stedman, who spend more time in here, especially Senator Wilkin, than we'd like to admit. But anyway, what I thought we'd do today, there's been a lot of interest in this bill as it moved forward from various angles, and the House had made numerous amendments and had some different concepts that they had amended into it, and there was previous conference committees that have pulled from both the House version and the Senate version, pulled on a good compromise. So there's a few issues left open. And what I thought I'd do today, because this is the first meeting and we may have several, depending on how things go over numerous days, is kind of go through where we're at to try to bring everybody up to speed, although I recognize this is a free conference, and in a free conference, technically the whole entire bill is on the table. The intent that I would like to see this committee follow is to try to honor the public process that has gone through the House and the Senate and try to leave intact the negotiating areas of our colleagues before us, even though none of the six of us sat on those two committees. There was a lot of effort put in by the colleagues that did. So I'm going to take a few minutes and kind of go through the compromise. Clearly that there's been flexibility from the Senate's position and the House's position, and that will be apparent as we go through this document. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the conference committee. It's titled Conference Committee with Limited Free Powers. It's for those of you in the audience, it's a little side-by-side, has the Senate bill in column B, the House in column D, column C and E are referenced to pages and line numbers, and then the column on the furthest right is the committee, the conference committee recommendations coming out of limited free powers. And the far right hand side, it'll say in the lead word if it was from the House version or the Senate version or some combination. There's a few of them that are in combination and not, well, none of the two bodies have all the best ideas, so as we move through these, we'll see that they flop back and forth. The item online, and it's going to be easier, I think, if I go down and reference a line number on the left on the spreadsheet. The first item that they discussed was the defined contribution benefit formula. The House version was accepted of 13% per year. And of course, there's always the earnings that are accumulated. The tier report started at 11.5%. The Senate moved it to 12.5. The House moved it to 13, and the conference committee decided to stay at 13. The next item on line 7, the contribution details. The Senate had incremental 50 basis points, or 0.5% increase per year, for 3 to 4 years, depending on the plan. That was deleted in the House plan, and currently it stays deleted the current employees under the PERS tiers one, two, and three, and tiers tier one and two are not asked to increase their employee contribution rate into the existing plans. I know there was a lot of interest amongst the press since about January on this issue and the employees, but clearly that is not in there in the final version. The employer on line 8, the issue there, the concept was the same between the House and the Senate. There's some amended verbiage that basically is a third way of saying the same thing, that neither the House nor the Senate version felt it was prudent that the contribution rate on the current tiers fall below the normal cost. And again, the normal cost for those that haven't been around this as much as others is substantially different than the past service cost. Those two and combined is the total cost, but the normal cost is what it cost basically to pay for today's benefits being accrued today. The past service rate is when you have an overfunded position and you have to increase contributions, an underfunded position, and you have to increase contributions to pick that up or pay it off over time. Or if you had an overfunded position, you'd have a negative past service cost. So the intent here by both bodies was to ensure that regardless of the condition of the plan, the contribution shall never fall below the normal service cost, because I think it's agreed that over time, plans have a tendency of becoming overfunded and underfunded. And when you have extremes, especially in the underfunded, you have some problems. And 9 is broken down into three areas. The Senate, this is for the employer side of the contribution, the Senate had a 4.5% to the defined contribution. The House had moved it to 5. And that, again, is referenced up to line 5. That's where that incremental increase is on line 5. That was accepted for the final bill to move forward. The item on 9B, the medical cost component, that is, in a lot of ways, going to be an actually calculated rate. But the way you'll see that when we get into how the health care is handled, that is to pay the health care for the retirees and employees. The other initially we're taking the Senate version, but that will be modified over time. The next item down line C is the HRA is the health reimbursement arrangement. That item is, our mechanism is put in place to help offset or subsidize premium payments or medical costs that the employees under the new tier would face after employment. The tier committee had recommended 1%, the Senate had moved it to 2%, the House had moved it to 2.5%, and now it sits at 3%. And that is referenced in that move, again, to how the health care is structured, and we'll get into that in a minute, to try to make sure that benefit available, that accumulation, that 3% is employer money, it's not employee, it's employer money, to be deposited on behalf of the employee, compounds technically tax-free because it's never taxed, and then it comes out tax-free on the employee. So when there was discussion earlier on whether to have the health reimbursement arrangement increased or potential taxable contributions in the benefit formula increased, that was one of the issues that the members thought that it would be nicer for the employees to have tax-free money than taxable money in the end when it comes out. The last item in Section 9, that DD benefits, death and disability, There's a couple of ways of handling that. The Senate initially thought that there would be or contemplated a selection made available to the employees, what they wanted as far as death benefits and disability, and then it, you know, they'd be charged accordingly. The House thought it would be nice to have it embedded in the plan, the employer paid for it, and everybody gets particular benefits, and that was decided or as the preferred alternative, and that's why that materializes out of or just shows up in the right-hand column, and it's not referenced in B or D. Yes.
On death and disability benefits, I mean, my understanding was that it was going to be 4% for peace officers and firefighters and 3% for other employees. Did the conference committee just meld that, or is that, or is it still 4 and 3 and averages out to about 0.35?
I'm not sure what the 4 and 3 are.
Well, my understanding was that the bill that came from the House side had 0.4% for firefighters and police and 0.3%
okay.
for others.
Right. Okay, see. All right. I thought you were referencing in full percentages. The correct. It's a blended rate depending on, it's an actuarial calculated rate depending on the benefits that were selected. Does that answer the question?
I'm not sure. I guess I'm trying to figure out if the employer of a peace officer is going to have to pay 0.4% or is going to be paying 0.35%.
It's a composite rate. It is 4 and 3. And there'll be individual calculations on it.
Okay. Okay. So the employer of a peace officer will pay 0.4%. The employer of public employee would.
Right. That's my.
Whether it's a fisheries biologist or
right.
a highway engineer would pay 0.3%.
Right. And that's my understanding. It depends on the ratio of police and fire versus the other group.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. The next page, page 2, under medical, there are quite a few macerations of this for a time, but the Senate handled the issue a little different than the House initially, and in the end we ended up blending them kind of together, but the primary focus of post-retirement health insurance came after at the age of 65 or Medicare age as it changes, and the Senate had no medical cost sharing after employment before age 65. The House in their deliberations changed the or had a different way of handling the post-65 health insurance, which was less expensive and had less benefits to the retired employee after 65, but they had some pre-65 health insurance cost sharing, which benefited the employee. And as we worked through the, or they worked through the discussion on that, it was decided that they would take the Senate version on the post-65 health insurance because it was a better benefit. And then they also decided to take Senate version on no cost sharing after employment and before age 65. And that's the reason why the health reimbursement arrangement was increased. And we can all, you know, if we had, well, six people sitting here, if we were to create the calculator sitting in front of Representative Kelly, we'd have all done it in probably six different ways. So it was kind of interesting to me to sit on the sidelines and watch this come together. But the end effect is the same. The employees will have a fund set aside to help them offset their premium. The retirees' share of the health insurance premium, currently the state picks all of it up. Now the retiree would be responsible after 10 years of service, when they're over the age of 65, for 30% of it. And if, as a reach, it goes up in 5-year increments and 5% increments, and then after 30 years of service, they would be responsible for 10% of it. Regardless of what the insurance premium is, after age 65, it'll always be a 90-10 split. That gives some protection to the retired employee that's 65, 70, 75, that doesn't have the ability to come back into the workforce, that they always know that it's, that split's going to stay constant. Next item 14, they picked up the Senate version. The retiree and survivors pay full premium until Medicare eligible. The next page, on page 3, this is some kind of cleanup language on 14A. So when you have a spouse and one of the parties, the party that is employed by the state, may not need the insurance and issues provided by their employment. They've got some election options here. The next two items, 15 and 16, and we get into the disability and the death benefit, and the House version was taking, again, there's different ways of constructing the same thing. It's a different method of construction. It goes to the same type of a solution. On the right-hand column, PF stands for police and fire. And there is some disability available and death benefit available, comparable to the existing tiers, tier 3 and tier 2 in the system. So there's parallel, and that's where the 35 basis point cost, 30 or 40 basis points, again, that's 0.41%, come into play to pay for this. The next item down, item 17, again, is that health reimbursement arrangement. Again, the Tier Committee recommended 1, the Senate moved to 2, the House moved to 2.5, and currently it stands at 3. And that is to help offset subsidize health insurance premiums and health care costs after employment. The next item, item 18, the health reimbursement arrangement can be used even if not participating in a state's medical insurance plan. The issue there was, once the benefit is earned by the employee and there's a separation of service, maybe the employee worked for 15 or 20 years, separated from service, did something else. The intent here is to not strip the employee of the benefits accumulated and have them benefit from their years of good service. Item 19. There was considerable discussion on how to handle the HRA, the health reimbursement arrangement. The Senate initial concept was, you have the benefit after 10 years of service. If you quit after 10 years of service, if you quit before 10 years of service, you have 5 years to come back in without interest, go back into employment, and be able to pick up where you left off. The House had a different opinion on that. They felt if you quit before 10 years of service, you should be able to come back at any time with interest restored, and the employer should track it in perpetuity. The the decided methodology of handling it was to have a cutoff date at some time certain in the future, so the employer, which we always seem to tend to refer to as the state, but in effect could be municipalities or school systems, should have at some point in time in the future the ability to say the employee is either going to reasonably come back or not come back. The age selected was age 65. On December 31st of the year in which you turn 65, if you have not returned to service, then that account balance is lost. And if you do come back, before that you get the inflation adjusted rate, so your purchasing power stays constant, but you don't get the accumulated deferred compounded interest. The issue of coming up with some time certain, if it's 5 years that the House, or excuse me, the Senate wanted, or in perpetuity that the House wanted, at some point in time, the employer needs to be able to say that the person is either passed away or is no longer coming back to service, reasonably assured. Otherwise, there's no way for the employer to know someone's deceased. And if the personal representative handling the estate doesn't bother to notify the employer, it could run on till people are living now to into their 90s.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to make sure I understand. So the employee, if they terminate from the municipality of Anchorage, can come back and work for a participating employer, which could be an estate, prior to the age of 65, or do they have to return to the municipality of Anchorage?
Either one, as we move that maceration back and forth.
Okay, thanks.
Either one, and then they can count those years.
Thanks.
The next item, the investment boards, created, you know, some interesting discussion too. The concept of the Senate was to can back up a little bit. The board structure is totally different from the proposed board structure is totally different from the current board structure. The current board structure spends roughly 80% of their time on appeals. The appeals under the 141 is going to run through the administrative law judges. So the board will not be dealing with appeals. The other two things the board deals with is agreeing on the actuarial assumptions and setting the contribution rates. So those two functions are moved over to the new board, along with the responsibilities of the assets and the liabilities. And selecting the board, the Senate version was to have a 9-member board. The Commissioner of Administration and the Commissioner of Revenue would sit on the board. There'd be 3 Alaska residents that are non-beneficiaries of the system. You could have worked for in the system at one time, but you would have had pushed all your ties to it, so you'd be a non-beneficiary. A finance officer of the municipalities, a finance officer of the school districts, and 1 member from PERS and 1 member from TERS. And we got to remember that all of the other members, administration, commissioner, the 2 commissioners, the finance officer and the school district finance officer are would be PERS members. The House had a little different view of the board. They thought that there should be less independent representation on the board and more representation by the employees. So they moved the PERS and TERS members from 1 to 2. In the discussion that took place, there was 2 major concerns. One was the interest that the board, or the opinion that the board should be more reflective of the employees. The other version was that the board needs to have representation from the non-beneficiaries, who are ultimately responsible, along with the beneficiaries, for any obligation that the benefit package may incur over time if there's a record shortfall. So as the discussions went on forward, it was decided that the non-beneficiaries would move from 3 members down to 2. and the municipal and school district financial officers would be combined, and they would have one, and then there'd be two PERS and two TERS members. So that's how the board is currently proposed. The term structure, the Senate set the board up similar to the permanent fund. It was recognized, I think most people in the state feel that the permanent fund board is a good functioning board. Appointments by the governor the House thought that 6-year terms were preferred over 3-year terms with a maximum of 2 and a 1-year break. So what was decided on, the Senate had, you could have up to 3 3-year terms and then you had to have a break of service. The committee decided that they would not take the 3 or the 6-year terms, they would go to a 4-year term, staggered, and then have no breaks required or unlimited service. The concept there is if you have a fully functioning board member that has the interest, shows up, and has good participation, leave them on the board. If they so choose, don't have an automatic trigger to remove them. And then with the staggered term, there was some concern that a governor may reappoint the entire board. I think they would have some issues if they did that, no matter what political affiliation that they would have, trying to do that to the permanent phone board also. So that is what drove that discussion. The next item, again, on the board 22A, goes into the staggered term issue, names coming forward, for selection. The board duties, the next one down, 23.
Mr. Chair, before you go on, sure. Back to 22A, and I don't know if this is just a problem with language in the chart, but in the House amended that was accepted by the previous conference committee, it says additional language that the terms of the 4 PERS members are staggered 3 years apart from the terms of the counterparts. It seems to me that 3 years works if you've got 6-year terms, but it should be staggered 2 years apart if you've got 4-year terms. So that the first year, for example, you might have a PERS person who goes out, the second year a TERS person, the third year a PERS person, and the fourth year a TERS person. So staggering seems to be a 2-year process rather than a 3-year process. Maybe that's what they meant, and this is just a misprint.
I think what they do is they reference back to the existing structure in the statutes on doing that. But we can. Initially, on the board side, there would be some shorter terms available to get the board in place and structure. What we did then, we tried to reinvent the wheel. We just went right back into the existing statutes and extracted it, is what they did. Does that answer your question?
It does, but I do think it has to be staggered 2 years. You don't want 2 PERS members coming off one after the other. It might be something staff can look into.
We can check into it. I think you'll find that that's been covered, and maybe there's just some difference in the way that information is being communicated. The board duties, the next one, 23, board duties, the Senate had none, not that the board didn't have any duties, and the House had some stuff spelled out in statute, and it was decided that statute wasn't appropriate place to handle a particular issue. So it was removed. The issue of the next one on item 24, there was some discussion on the policies of the, there's quite a bit of discussion whether what you should put in statute, what you should put in regulation. The Senate had more of an inclination to leave things in regulation versus statute. The House here added to assist the retirement system administrator prescribing policies for the operation of the retirement system. That was added. The next item, number 25, on board compensation. Actually, the Senate just had the current structure of $150 a day honorarium. The permanent fund gets $400 a day, so the House decided that because when they were talking about the boards, and there was a lot of parallels between the permanent fund board and the arms board, that they had moved up to $400, so the current standing is for a $400 honorarium per day, so it's similar to the permanent fund. The next item on ad hoc PRPAs, the Senate had a fund ratio of 110% underfunding before that could be paid out. The House moved it to 105, and that's where it stands today at 105. The next item was deleted. That was reference to the legislative employees being credited for a year of service. The Senate had moved it, currently at 60, had moved it to 120, which is, a full session. There was some discussion whether to modify that down several days or change the verbiage to this a session, but it was just ultimately decided to delete it. There's been some issues there with abuse, so I think there's some other methodology that can be put in place to deal with that. The next item. The House addressed where they're trying to close some loopholes where the health insurance can be passed on from a covered spouse to the spouse and then on to another party. If something happened to the spouse, that's kind of clean up. Page 6. University of Alaska, there's some issues there with the university that they were unable to agree on. The Senate had put in some verbiage to address the university's concern. The House had changed it and removed the provision that the university may create a mandatory retirement plan. This item remains open and we'll probably come back and visit that. There is some language at the university has floated around, and I think of the open items, this one is one that I think we could come to a conclusion on fairly easy when the time's appropriate. And there's some on item 32. There was an amendment made to put some language in there about folks that make false statements. That on the final version, it removed existing language that a person who knowingly makes a false statement forfeits all rights under this chapter. It's kind of cleanup language. There were some definitional issues on item 33 that were added. By the House, there was some lack of interest from Department of Benefits as far as the appropriateness of it, and it was decided that would it would go with the Senate version and not address the issue. Cost savings measures, line 34. Again, we got into the philosophical discussion of what should be in statute, what should be in regulation. The House felt there should be some regulations, the Senate felt it should be in, excuse me, the House felt it should be in statute, the Senate felt it should be in regulations. It was decided that regulations was the best place, so we wouldn't be unduly restrictive on the division of retirements and benefits. And the issue here is that we don't, with all best intentions, put some stuff in statutes that actually restricts the department to go after their cost savings, and clearly both bodies, the House and the Senate, I think are equal in their determination to work or interact with the board on cost savings initiatives. Number 35, the House had put in language that required an annual report to the legislature by retirement benefits on implementation of cost savings measures. That was accepted. And with 35 being in place, 34 was pulled off the table. Item 36. Had to do with added conditional language that makes an effective date retroactive to July 1st, 05. That was set. The items 37 and 38, we'll come back to those in a minute. The last item, 39, had to do with financial statements. They decided to pick up the House version of financial fiscal notes, because there was some changes done that in the House that weren't done in the Senate, so there was some cleanup work there. Now, if we can touch on the major, at least what I feel is the major points of disagreement, or differences of opinion, I should say, not disagreements, but difference of opinion, and is items 37 and 38. They were both floor amendments in the House. They remain open. There's no intention of the chair today to try to resolve these items. It's just to try to bring all the members, hopefully, along together. So we'll agree to try to honor the work that our colleagues have done in the past to get us to the basic final 3 points, which are 37, 38, and then to deal with the university. I would like to, on 37 is a sunset provision, 38 is to run concurrent defined benefit and defined contribution selections into the future. We've got some issues of potential diminishment of benefits if we were to ever adopt those and try to modify them in the future. And I think maybe at the next meeting we'll get into some more detailed discussion on those pros and cons. But there's a lot of cleanup work on, if I could reference, on the House bill on page 15. There's retirement plan choices that go from page 15, line 15, to the next page on line 2. Next item of page 4. Line 20, it's retirement plan choices, to the following page, page 85, through line 7. The next item is page 115, line 13. Through line 29. There is a glitch in some of the reference pages, so I just want to touch bases on those areas to make sure that, and I think the glitch is on the section on page 41. Page 41, line 5, and goes through page 45, line 11. We have, there's some proposed language. It's acceptable to the university. It's kind of, on that particular item, it's kind of in the middle. I think there's been a good working relationship with the House and the Senate, and when we do go through the side-by-side, it's pretty hard to argue that either one of the two bodies is inflexible. Both bodies have moved to the middle to come up with a better bill, and as we go forward, hopefully this final group will continue a good public process and work towards the middle and stay flexible, even though I recognize that as we go forward in the last hours of this session, some folks that don't sit at this table would like to give the impression that one or both bodies are inflexible. Clearly that's not the case, and we can reference the ongoing work of our colleagues to do that now. We could maybe have some questions or some brief comments, and then what I'd like to do is adjourn the meeting for some time in the future to make sure that everybody's had time to look at those items. I'd like to get some feedback. I recognize this is a free conference. I'd like to get some feedback from each individual on their thoughts, public or private, doesn't matter to me, on trying to hold the point of discussion, at least initially, I'd like it to the final solution, but to the points that are open, and make sure everybody has some language on the university issue. And what we'll do is we'll recess to the call of the chair, and we'll try to work forward and compromise. I just want to make it clear that the Senate is not cast in concrete, and we are flexible, but there is, you know, some issues, just like the House, that are a little more reluctant than others to move on. And who would like to, anybody would like to make any comments before we have recess? Okay, with that, we'll recess to the call of the chair, and then talk to my aide, Miles Baker, make sure that there's some language, that you have a copy of the language of the university. I think once we look at that language, I think that issue, I'd like to deal with that one last. It'll be easier, I think, to deal with than some of the other ones, and it's nice to close the meeting on an easier issue than a harder issue. And when we come back...
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
I might suggest that we would be better off resolving those issues where there can be ready agreement made prior to... then basically we know what we're working with, and we know what are the bones of contention at the end.
Yeah, I mean, we can certainly do that. When we come back, we can talk about if we want to put the university first or last. I don't, you know, I always just like to close the meeting on an upper note rather than, you know, working on tougher issues right at the end. But clearly 37 and 38, I think, are going to be our toughest issues. Just reference that the previous committee wasn't able to resolve them.
And also, if I may, just also that those are issues within the presumption of the defined benefit plan or the defined contribution plan. must be included in this piece of legislation, and there are some of us here at the table that are truly not in agreement that even that entire component of this bill is appropriate to include. So again, I'd kind of like to resolve the, I still keep the options open to be looking at the biggest possible picture within the bill.
I would agree, and I certainly recognize that comment that I think all six of us sitting here could look through the plan and or 141 and make quite a list of things that we'd individually like to change, and it is a compromise and collective work of many committees. But you know, we can, as when we go through to find a resolution to 37 and 38, do it in a more broader aspect than partition it down. I mean, I'm certainly open to putting them both on the table at the same time and working for a solution. So the agreed solution deals, you know, kind of as a package. I'm open to that as long as the package is reasonable in scope. And so it's clear what we're doing. Otherwise, if it gets too many macerations, then we should partition it out. But clearly the idea here is to move to the middle to, you know, to a solution. Senator Elton.
Mr. Chair, I kind of appreciate those comments, and I don't want to mischaracterize them. And so I'm just going to say that, and I think that maybe Representative Hawker was also saying this, that as we work, especially on the two issues that were furthest apart, I mean, we're six bright people sitting here at the table, and moving toward the middle doesn't necessarily mean picking one element from one side and another element from another side. I mean, I think that we have the obligation to think broadly and not just look at this as one bill being, or one version of the bill being this end of the spectrum, the other version being the other end of the spectrum, and then trying to find something in between. I mean, I think that we have the ability as six bright people to think outside of that box and look at other potential solutions also.
And the chair does recognize we are in free conference and we can virtually rewrite the entire bill. But I would have to agree with Senator Elton that I think if we broaden the scope a little bit, along with Representative Hawker's idea of broadening it a little bit so we can deal with those two issues and possibly, you know, as we move towards the middle, you know, have a solution that takes care of both of them. But there is a limit on how far we should stray, in my opinion. Any other comments? Okay, we'll recess to the call chair.
Good job, Mr. Chairman.